This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
I am Glenn McGeek from Ocala, Florida, and you're listening to a special monthly episode, the trail riding episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for April the 17th, episode 894. This episode is brought to you by the North American Trail Ride Conference and Texas Haynet. Good morning, horse world.
I'm so happy it's Thursday.
Just an ordinary day.
If you love to ride horses, but you'd rather ride on a trail than in an arena, I think I know a sport just for you.
We're out. We're getting to the first mark. We're a little ahead of time.
Expect nothing less than full-blown chaos.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us here at Horses in the Morning. We're so glad that you stopped by. If you're a new listener, welcome to the show. Horses in the Morning is part of the Horse Radio Network. We have 11 different shows on the Horse Radio Network, and we're happy that you're here. And we were waiting for Alice to show up, my co-host for today. And Alice, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you sound much better now. We had a little bit of technical difficulty, or Alice would have been here from the beginning. So, good morning.
Good morning.
You sound absolutely terrific now. So, you're good.
Okay, well, it's my cell phone instead of the Skype thing. So, who knew?
Okay. Well, you're here. That's the important part. Alice Jovich, she is from Arlington, Texas, and she's going to be joining us on the third Thursday of every month. And we're going to do a North American Trail Ride Conference episode where we talk about trail riding. You know, Alice, we predict that about 70%, 70 to 80% actually of our listeners are trail riders and not competitors at all. They're people who have horses in the backyard and like to go out and trail ride, some, you know, for an hour and some for a little bit longer. So, you know, I'm so glad that we're able to do this now.
I'm excited about it, too. Trail riding has been my passion for about 12 years now. I started with a trail horse, and it looks like I'm ending up with a trail horse. So.
Well, we're going to learn a little bit more about Alice as we go along here. Jennifer, do you have an On Today show for us, or do you want us just to talk about it?
You can talk about it this morning.
Okay. I figured I was busy
dealing with technical issues.
That's Jennifer. She is our producer for today. Coach Jen, also host of the Horse Tip Daily Show here on the Horse Radio Network. Alice, we have a couple of guests coming up. We have Donna Johnson. Tell us just a little bit about her.
Donna Johnson is an NATRC vet judge. She lives in Colorado, and she travels all around the country judging the riders at NATRC competitions. She was born in New York, but now lives in Colorado. And she has competed in NATRC since 1992.
Oh, so she's been around a while.
Yeah.
She knows how this works. Well, good. We're going to be talking to her a little bit later on. And then is it Elena Summer?
Alana?
Yep.
Yeah.
And what's she going to talk to us about today?
She's going to talk to us about how to be comfortable while camping with your horse. Not everybody has a living quarter trailer or, you know, the means to get a living quarters trailer. And some people actually just like to camp, unlike you, Glenn, which I know that that's not your passion. so she's going to talk to us a little bit about what to pack and what to take and how to be comfortable in inclement weather and that kind of thing.
Oh, we need to listen carefully to this one, Glenn. Listen very carefully and take notes.
Inclement weather is something that we've had lots of experience with camping. We, you know, I would like to camp if it had a bathroom, and you know, if there was, you know, campers with a bathroom are good for me.
Yeah.
That whole tent thing, not so much.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the campgrounds that we use do have bathrooms, some kind or another. So.
Let me clarify the type of bathroom that I want. I want the ones with the little soaps and the little shampoo bottles. That type of bathroom.
Oh, the kind that you find at a hotel.
Yes, that type of bathroom is perfect for me.
Gotcha.
You know, we started this topic of camping and going long distance packing and trail riding on Tuesday with the Certified Horsemanship Association, and they really covered it from the angle of what do you do with your horses, how do you picket them, how do you tie them, how do you hobble them, all of that. And so today we're going to be taking a little bit different direction. We're going to be talking about the people, the thing, what you have to do while you're camping and things to look out for and stuff like that. So that's all coming up on today's show. But first, Alice, let's get to know you a little bit. Tell us a little bit about your history as far as horses are concerned.
Well, I was a horse-crazy kid whose parents didn't really appreciate horses. I used to beg. I had every kind of music lesson imaginable, and there was a stable across the street from the college, and I was like, well, when I'm done with my flute lesson and my piano lesson and my voice lesson, can I just go take a riding lesson? And they were like, no. So it wasn't until...
Well, wait a minute. Were your parents musicians?
No, my mom's a nurse and my dad is a retired banker. I don't really know how that happened. I think my mom got me piano lessons when I was 5 because I had really bad ADD and they were trying to get me to sit still a little bit, which ironically has translated into my career since I'm a music therapist and I often work with children with music that have ADD. So
I want to talk to you a little bit about that later on, too.
Okay.
So did they actually allow you to get a lesson, or was that more of an adult thing then?
No, I didn't start riding until I went to grad, and I was at Texas Women's University in Denton, Texas, and they had horseback riding as a PE class. And so I signed up, and it was only $100 extra a semester, and so I started taking lessons every, I think 3 times a week. And then on the weekends, you could pay a little bit of money and ride extra. And I had a boyfriend at the time who sort of quit being my boyfriend because I started riding more than I spent time with him.
Oh, yay, old story there.
Yeah, that happens a lot.
Yeah. Well, I was like, oh, wow, I'd rather ride the horses than go to Waco and hang out with you. That was not a good spot.
Yeah, that happens a lot. That happens a lot.
So then I moved to Kentucky for my first job, and I had done hunter jumper up to that point and a little bit of dressage. So the letters still completely confused me because nobody ever explained them. They just said, okay, go to C and make a circle. But nobody, they acted like I should already have known. And so that was all kind of a muddle. But when I moved to Kentucky, the main horses that I came in contact with were Tennessee Walkers. And so I answered an ad in the paper and found a 2.5-year-old Tennessee Walker. And I knew a lot about horses. I'd been riding for 2 whole years, 3 times a week. So that could have been really bad, but it wasn't. He was really, really awesome. And then later on, I kind of got back into dressage more seriously and eventually ended up with a Shagia Arabian horse who did dressage and then later trail. And then I found when I got back to Texas in the early 2000s, I discovered NATRC, and that's been my focus ever since.
So I wanted to get back a little bit to your real job. You said you do music therapy. What exactly is that?
Music therapy is the use of music as your modality to work on other problems. So like occupational therapists and physical therapists have their bag of tricks. Our bag of tricks is music related. So if somebody has like attention deficit, or we might use music to help increase their attention span. Somebody has gross or fine motor skill issues, we will use music to work on the gross and fine motor skill issues. And it doesn't seem like so much work as some of the other modalities. The kids and adults respond really well to the music, and they work on their issues kind of under the radar without ever realizing that they've been working.
Is this playing an instrument, or could
sometimes
it be anything?
It could be anything. Sometimes they play the instruments. I have some older teenagers who I teach like an adapted piano lesson to. Sometimes we use singing. I have another gentleman I work with. We're working on his speech skills. So, try to get him to enunciate his words. I'm getting ready to start a new facet to my career, which is called music therapy assisted childbirth, where we assist women in labor using pre-recorded music, but it's, you know, it's there to help them do visualization and relaxation exercises so they can potentially avoid.
You mean it's not just to cover up the swear words?
No, but you know that it does come in handy for that.
Now, this is interesting, too, because music is not something that I am good at or qualified at. We owned an acting company for 10 years, and music was part of our shows. But I was the owner of the company, and I played the king, and nobody would let me sing or do anything musical at all. So that gives you an idea. So I'm not too sure I don't know if music therapy would be a good one for me. So my question is, can you determine if it, you know, really quickly in your first session whether music therapy is going to be good for someone?
Yeah, usually we do a comprehensive assessment on somebody. You know, like you have a list of activities that you try or, you know, questions that you ask the parents, and then you do different musical interventions to see how the client responds, and then you make a recommendation from there.
So if they're completely tone deaf like me, you go on, yeah, it's time to do swimming therapy or something else.
They have that too. But, I mean, it doesn't matter. You don't have to be musical to use music therapy effectively. It doesn't have to be, you know, there's lots of people I work with that aren't musical, but they still benefit from music therapy.
Like, I watch American Idol, and I'm sitting there watching, and I never agree with the judges. So that just tells me, you know, I never agree.
Well, they're pretty
not
cool.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the NATRC, which is the North American Trail Ride Conference. Tell us the history of that and what the NATRC does.
The NATRC stands for the North American Trail Ride Conference, and they are a national organization based in Colorado, and they they're a national organization based out of Colorado, and we have seven regions across the United States. And so when you compete at a regional level, but then you also are competing at a on a national level as well. So there are opportunities for like the beginners to win awards within their own region, and then as you move up the levels and you ride in the harder levels, there are awards to win at a national level as well. The rides consist of a veterinary judge and a horsemanship judge. And at the end of the weekend, you get two full comprehensive cards that tell you all the stuff you did right and all the stuff you should go home and work on.
So
I have
it's kind of like dressage that way. You get your score sheet. Yeah.
Yes, but there's lots more detail. I mean, you start with 100 points at the beginning of the weekend, and then they deduct points from the cards for things that either go wrong or, like, if your horse has change in his metabolics or his soundness, or you could lose a pulse or respiration point. So at the end of the weekend, you end up with your score minus the deduction and also comments. And the comments are often very positive, and the judges tend to tell you what you've done well versus, you know, just screwed that up, which is very helpful because you can go and work on stuff.
Well, let's back up a little bit. What is the competition?
Sure. What
do you do? What is the competition?
Okay. On Friday afternoon, typically, or Saturday morning, if you can't get there on Friday, you check in with the judges, and they have you circle the horses, trot the horses out and circle them. It's similar to an endurance ride, except in endurance, they pretty much just have you trot out and back, or, you know, straight out and straight back.
Right. Right.
We usually circle each direction because the judges are very concerned about starting a sound horses only and observing any anomalies that a horse may have. That Friday evening, you get your map, and we have a ride meeting where the trail master will go over the trail and tell everyone, like, where the water is. Sometimes we'll tell you where the pulse and respiration stops are going to be. Sometimes they like to surprise us. They'll go over what the miles per hour is going to be for the day and, like, how long, what your window is. And we always have a window of time. So in competitive trail riding, if you have if you're going to ride 15 miles at 4 miles per hour, but then there's two pulse and respiration stops, you get a minimum time and a maximum time. And so you have this half-hour window that you have to complete the ride to keep all your points for the day.
So really, it's kind of an optimum time kind of thing where you're trying to come in at a certain time as opposed to the fastest.
Exactly. Yeah, if you're the fastest, that's not necessarily a good thing. So it could be as long as you're in your window.
Hey, Jennifer, you and Beaker do well because he's never fast.
He's never the fastest. No.
No. He might be the slowest. Do you get points off
of being the slowest
too? Because
only if you're as long as you're within your 30-minute window, there's nothing happens. If you're early or if you're late, you lose a point. Your horse loses a point per minute for every minute it was early or late. But
now,
that doesn't happen very often.
Are there challenges along the way along your run?
There are. No, there are the opportunities. We have opportunities.
Okay.
So they're lovingly referred to as obstacles, yes. The judges will do anything from hide and watch how you do to set something up along the way for you to actually, you know, do an obstacle for them specifically. Like this past weekend, I was at a ride at Pole Canyon Ranch in West Texas, and my favorite obstacle of the whole weekend was they put a log up next to the mounting block. And we had to side pass our horse in hand up to the mounting block and then get on the mounting block and mount. And pleasure division, which I've already noviced out, so I can't ride novice anymore. My obstacles are a little harder. And so we had to side pass over and then do an offside mount. And my horse, he knows this. He did it. But then I made a crucial error. I didn't put the reins over his head to show him I was going to the mounting block. And he started to side pass away. So it was perfect. I mean, he was just perfect. And then it was my fault. It was totally my fault. And my daughter was right behind me. She watched my mistake, and she did it just spot on. And, you know, so sometimes your fellow competitors will teach you.
Will there be obstacles that you're not? You said the judges hide sometimes. So are there obstacles that are not plainly? In other words, it's not plainly an obstacle. You don't necessarily know it's an obstacle.
Yes. In fact, at the same competition, our horsemanship judge climbed up this really steep hill, and I mean, she was way up above us, and you didn't see her until later. You knew she was there somewhere because we saw her helper. But steep hill to ride down, and it was a long steep hill, and she was way up above us, so she could see us for a really long time. And because when you don't know the judges are there, people don't always ride properly. I mean, you know, you kind of cleaned it up when you know there's a judge.
Right.
But in this case, I was good. I was really happy because I typically blow those because it'll just be that moment where I'm, you know, scratching my head or getting out a candy bar or whatever. I'm not riding properly, so.
Oh, so eating while riding is not considered good. So you don't want to eat during opportunities.
Absolutely, you should eat while you're riding. I'm just saying that sometimes you know you're digging around in your saddlebag, and you don't always notice that you're just not always paying attention to how you're riding while you're digging around in your saddlebag.
Gotcha. Keep your heels down while you dig in your saddlebags. Got it. Like I said, I'm taking notes today. I got it.
Right.
So now tell us, do most people ride, is it like endurance? What are the distances usually, by the way?
When you're in the novice division or the competitive pleasure division, you will ride up to 40 miles in 2 days.
Whoa.
It's a minimum.
Okay, so you're putting some miles on.
Yeah, but it's not very fast. It'll usually be like 3.75 miles per hour to about 4.5 miles per hour.
Okay.
So it's not, you know, really, people that hike will walk or hike that quickly. So, I mean, you're really,
right.
You know, you're mostly walking, but there's some trotting. And of course, that depends on the terrain as well, because, you know, some terrain is more challenging, so you just go more slowly. In the open division, you will go 50 to 60 miles in the same 2 days, and your pace will be typically 5 to 6 miles an hour, though it can be as fast as 7 miles an hour. a junior rider was telling me this last weekend that they did a ride in California a couple weeks ago, and it was up and down mountains all the way, and it was 7 miles an hour. And I just, I was fast.
That's a trot. You're going on
it
a
is,
trot.
It is, absolutely. Yeah. Slower in, down in Texas, especially if it gets hotter, because we try really hard not to overstress the horses.
Well, what type of horses are you using? Are you using Arabians? Are you using gated horses? What are you using?
We are using any kind of horse you want. Most people come to this sport using the horse that they have. Like in my case, it's something I'd always wanted to do. I learned about NAPRC in the 90s, but the year I lived in Iowa, where I could have done it, it flooded, and so all the rides got canceled. And I had a big Tennessee Walker then and wasn't worried. Well, I didn't, you know, I was new, but I was going to just ride him because that was what I had. My Shaggy Amare did okay. I mean, she wasn't brilliant, but she did all right. I had a retired endurance horse who couldn't do 50s and 100s anymore, but he was a pretty good competitive trail horse for a few years until he just, you know, his arthritis caught up with him. You know, there's gated horses. I would say that foxtrotters are probably overall the most successful of all the gated horses, just from a historical perspective. More foxtrotters have won the President's Cup, which is our highest award, than any other gated horse.
Go ahead. What do you ride?
Okay, I ride a half Arab, half Pasifino, and he's not gated, except when he's really angry. Or sometimes he gets, like, I heard Karen talk about her horse having helicopter legs the other day, and I think he does that sometimes, too. It's like he gets in between his trot and his canter, and he's not really sure what he's doing.
Well, he's a Pasifino Arabian. He's got all kinds of mental issues. He needs music therapy.
He actually likes it when I sing, so we're good there. My other horse, not so much. She tossed me the last time I was singing to her. So.
That's funny. So the Pasifino Arabian, what gates are we using there?
Mostly we trot. He really likes to canter, and I've been riding with a heart rate monitor recently at the recommendation of some endurance rider friends, and I've discovered that his heart rate is actually lower at the canter than it is at the trot. He's got a real easy little lope, and he'll switch back and forth as the terrain needs it to be. And he does a little bit of a troca sometimes, you know, it's kind of like a box trot. It's that when I'm showing him to the judges, I want to make sure he's trotting solid because I don't want him to mistake his funky gait for anything other than being funky gait. So
does he have the mind of the Pasifino or the mind of the Arabian?
I think Liberty's mind is unique to him. I don't know whose mind he has. You know, when I got him, I spent the first 2 years reminding myself that if I'd wanted a quarter horse, I should have bought a quarter horse. but you know, since he was not a quarter horse. But he's 12, almost 13 now, and we've been a team for about seven years. And he's just the best horse I've ever had. He's just, you know, he's my little buddy. And, you know, like when I go to catch him for a competition, we have to do laps around the pasture before he comes in. People are like, well, you could train that out of him. And I'm like, you try, you know. But he always comes back.
That's your
warm-up. Exactly. Yeah. It's a game. It's just part of his person. It's just a game. Because he looks at you like, let's see how long you're going to take today to play my game, you know. So, but, you know, he's just a cool little horse. And I've been really happy with him.
So this is a weekend thing. So you guys are camping probably all together, I would assume. Is it much like the endurance where everybody gets to know each other and really does help each other out in the trail if somebody gets in trouble?
Helpful to other people. I mean, you will, you know, help your competitor, and then they will turn around and beat you. And that's okay because it's not really about, you know, it's fun to get the ribbons, but it's really about improving your own skills and, you know, and being there in the camaraderie with your friends, you know, and that's what I like the most about it is you know, I came for the sport because it was a challenge and it was hard and it was something I'd never done before, but I keep coming back for the people as much as for
the
riding.
Where we lived in Pennsylvania, there was a huge, they had a huge weekend trail ride that thousands of people would show up for. So I want to ask you, on that score sheet that you have for the NATRC, are there deductions for the amount of beer you drink or not?
No. Most people, I don't know anyone that actually drinks beer while they're riding because that would be distracting.
No, I meant in the evenings around the campfire.
No, no deductions.
Okay, good, because this place, Jennifer, I don't know if you remember that place. I don't know what it was called, but that literally thousands of people would descend on it one weekend a year, and I swear there was more beer consumed there than probably in the whole state of Pennsylvania that weekend.
Oh, that's funny. No, we're all pretty reasonable. We know people that it's just part of their persona that they always have a beer in their hands, but then most people, I would say, that's not true. You know, it's a family opportunity. In Region 4, we typically always have a church service either Saturday night or Sunday morning, you know, if you want to come. And, you know, I mean, it doesn't get out of hand ever, I don't think. At least it never has, as long as I've been doing it, you know, not since.
At least not in Texas.
When it got out of hand, I was asleep, so I missed it.
Well, now I'm taking a look at the website, too, and it appears that, by the way, that's at natrc.org. And it appears that, like endurance, that some people are also going for mileage, you keep track of mileage. And I'm looking at the website here and seeing some people's accumulation of mileage. Now, I'm looking at Ken Wolgram, who was the President's Cup Award winner in 2013. He did a lot of miles. It was like 14,000 miles. That's not 1 year, is it?
Oh, no. That's probably... There's a list for the rider's mileage, and there's also a list for the horse's mileage. So,
okay. And that's lifetime mileage.
Correct. I believe that the highest mileage horse right now is a horse named Elmer Bandit, and he passed away a couple of years ago at the age of 37, I believe. But he had the highest number of miles in NATRC, and he was ridden by several people. You know, so, I mean, it wasn't just him being ridden by one person, but he did have just one owner, I believe.
Huh. Interesting. Very interesting. Well, Jennifer is going to get our first guest on the line here, and I know that you had a product you wanted to do today as well.
Yes. I discovered this product before I discovered NATRC, but there is a lady in California named Evelyn Allen. Her business is called Just for Horse and Round. And that's, you know, www for horsin and then a dash round.com. And she makes custom tights for people. They're all colorful. If you ever look through any of our photography pictures, we have a couple of different photographers in our region. One is called Optical Harmonics, and the other one is Tier 1 Photos. You can see that I am often wearing really, really bright tights, and they're incredibly crazy, and people are always making fun of me. Another one of our riders, Johnny Jewell, who is a past President's Cup winner, she often gets her tights from there, too. So they're comfortable, and she will make them to your specs, and they can be plain. They don't have to be crazy. She will make them.
She'll make them actually to fit. So you do measurements and send them to her, and she just keeps that she keeps that on file?
Yeah, she keeps it on file. She keeps, you know, and then she has newly added some stretch denim tights. So
they're becoming very popular, yeah.
Yeah, and I have a sample of the fabric sitting here on my desk, and I've just ordered a pair. My friends are going to tease me, though, because they're plain.
I got to tell you, I'm looking at the pictures here, and some of these tights are pretty wild.
Yeah. I buy fabric on eBay. I used to make my own tights, but I'm too busy, and I like Evelyn so much better than anything I could make. So I sometimes, if I see fabric I really like, I'll buy the fabric, and then I'll send it to her. And I have these really bright green and really bright red tights. They're the same pattern, but they're, I don't know what they are, but they're wild. People are like, wow. And then I have a pair that are this rainbow pattern that has the silver snake skin all over the top. And the photographer teased me that that my tights were going to break his camera because of the receptivity.
These are pretty wild. So what's it run to have a custom? I didn't even know anybody was making custom tights. So that's number one. What does it run to have a pair of custom tights made?
You know, I hate to speak specifically because I know that the prices vary depending on what you want. I think they start around $50 or $60.
Okay. So that's
it's not
bad at all.
I mean, I hate to announce a number and then have her be like, because they're all different. It depends on what features. Like, she'll make them boot cut or low rise. She'll put fringe on them. My daughter has a bunch of tights that have fringe on the side. But she loved that when she was younger. Now, not so much. She's 16 now, so the fringe isn't so cool. But
I want fringe, Glenn. My birthday's coming.
They have the fringe tights are fun. I mean, I had some too. She and I had some that matched, but she wore the fringe much better than I did.
That's funny. And how do people get them? They just give her a call? Is that the best way?
Giving her a call. I think her phone number's on her website. But hang on, I also think I have it here.
She's
easiest to reach by email, and I think that her email is thetightslady@att.com.
.net. Yep. Thetightslady@att.net. Yep. I have it right here.
Yep. That's your best
way.
She's a school teacher during the day, so, keep after her because she gets really, really busy, especially this time of year when people are wanting a lot of tights. Oh, I have her phone number, too. It's 619-691-0242.
And that's the Tights Lady. You can find the website at justforhorsen-round.com, and Jennifer will put a link to that in the show notes as well. So that is the product review for today. And next up, we are going to your first guest, who Jennifer has on the line here. Tell us about Donna.
Donna is a NATRC vet judge. She has been judging since 2003, and she lives in Colorado, and she travels all over the country. I know one of her favorite judging partners has recently moved to Texas, but they still like to meet up and judge together whenever they can. And she stays really, really busy, and she doesn't get to compete as much as she'd like, unfortunately, because she spends a lot of time judging and working. So she's going to talk to us about conditioning the horse for competition or for general trail riding.
Good morning, Donna.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I'm honored to be here.
So, Donna, tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got started in NATRC.
I moved to Colorado in October of 1990, specifically to be able to buy a horse and afford it because I grew up on Long Island and it just doesn't work there for a person in their early 20s. And I bought an Arabian mare at an auction, which I probably would not recommend to anybody to do. And back in those days, there wasn't the internet or anything, so you had to do research the old-fashioned way by actually reading books and learned the difference between endurance and competitive trail riding and decided I really liked the aspect of competitive trail riding. And in June of 92, I did my first competitive trail ride, and I was hooked. And I loved it, and with that and changes in my life, I decided to go back to veterinary school. And then after vet school, I decided I wanted to judge NATRC because I put so much effort into the sport over the years.
So when you became a vet judge, what were some of your observations what are some of your observations as a judge about horses that are new to competition and how they come to the sport the first time? Are most of them pretty well conditioned, or do they typically come in the first time and then realize they need to do more work?
Oh, you kind of get both avenues of that. Some horses, they get to a point where they're exhausted on Saturday and riders have to pull the horse from competition because they just can't make it through the next day and you don't want a real issue out on the trail there. And then others, you know, they get their horse all ready to go and they come through it just fine. So you kind of get, you get a mix of both.
So when you are talking to people about competition and like people that are interested in starting a competitive trail, what type of program do you recommend to them for getting started?
I recommend a long, slow distance training. So you don't wake up the next morning, you know, if you're a person and you say, next year I'm going to run the Boston Marathon, and you wake up the next morning and go out and run 26 miles. That's just not going to happen. So the same thing, what you would do with yourself, you need to do with your horse. So I recommend, you know, starting, you know, if it's a horse that's fresh off the pasture, you've never done hardly anything with the horse, you know, I recommend getting out there maybe, you know, 3 days a week, doing a half hour a day or so of just some walking with some little trotting, and then slowly build that up over the first month to where you're out there by the end of that first month, maybe an hour to an hour and a half, you know, doing 5 to 7 miles a day or so. And then by the end of that month, you'd be starting to add some canter work into what your training program. Maybe by, you know, starting in the second month, you want to build it up even more. You're going to go more miles a day, but don't increase your speed too much, because endurance before speed is really what you need to work these horses on. And, you know, maybe over the third month, that's when you can start increasing your speed a little bit until you're out there a couple days a week doing 15 to 20 miles on those horses so that they get ready for it.
So if you're starting to increase your distance, you don't want to also increase your speed at the same time, correct?
Not at first, you don't.
Okay. And what kind of distance do most people need to ride each week? Like, say, you know, your average novice rider? Because I know some people start out and they actually over-condition their horses because they're riding them too much. So how do you balance that?
Now that's a tough one to know how to balance that. It's, you know, you have to look at the terrain you have also to work on. You know, if you live out in the plains, although I've ridden in Kansas and Nebraska where I found many hills, regardless of what people think, Kansas is not totally flat. And, you know, if you can get some hill work, if you think about going up a nice, you know, slow hill of about a half a mile long, that's worth a mile to a mile and a half of flat work. So that you know, depends on your terrain as far as how many miles you should be putting in. But, a novice rider, they, by the time they're ready to go, they should be putting in easily, you know, 30 miles a week.
Okay. So do you, in your own personal conditioning in the past, or like people that you recommend conditioning to, do you see value in using a heart rate monitor as the people are conditioning their horses?
If you're really into numbers, you can certainly do that. And then that way, you know, there is two types of conditioning, and I don't know how specific we want to get here this morning with the audience. You know, you've got aerobic conditioning and anaerobic conditioning, and if you have a heart rate monitor, you can probably figure those out a little bit better. But, you know, I've never used a heart rate monitor to condition horses, and, you know, my horses have usually done okay in competition if I've been able to stick to a good program. So that's kind of a hard one. You know, people who like numbers and are into gadgets certainly find a big benefit in that.
Well, you know, I wouldn't need it for the horse. I would need the heart rate monitor for me. Can we hook one up to each? Can we put one on the horse and me? Yeah.
You bet. They do have human heart rate monitors, and that actually brings up a really good point. I know we're talking about conditioning the horse here, but you do have to remember to condition yourself as well. Because if you're not in condition, there are two sides to it. Exactly. You are a team when you're out there.
Well, you know, and it is true, and I don't think I'm speaking out of turn here. If your horse has been out in the field doing nothing, chances are pretty good that you've been doing nothing too.
Correct.
I mean, I'm just being real here, right? I mean, you know, you probably haven't been working out in the gym either. So
that is correct.
Do you find you're a vet judge, so you're out there, you see these competitions? Well, first, one question before we get to that. So you're talking about building it up over a period of time. What would you say on average, and I know every horse is different, every rider is different, but on average, are you looking at 3 months, two, 3 months before you're really ready to get out there for your first competition? What is there a time frame that you would give?
Yeah, that's a hard one because you do have to look at what your starting point is with the horse. And, again, if you talk about, you know, it starts snowing in November and you don't do anything all the way into April, you're probably talking, you know, at least 2 to 3 months. Minimum 2, 3 would probably be perfect before you get out there. If you've been able to ride a little bit during the winter, you know, obviously the daylight is shorter, so you're not getting out there quite as much, then, you know, you're looking at maybe, you know, 2 months if you've had some riding on the horse during the winter.
Now, you've done this long enough. You've been doing this for a long time. So you, the people show up, you do that initial vet check basically to see if the horses are sound. But in 5 minutes, you can probably tell whether that person's going to make the whole weekend or not, conditioning-wise.
That's a hard one. Sometimes, you know, the horses are pretty hyped up when they get off the trailer. Especially new horses to the sport, they get off the trailer and all of a sudden they're surrounded by 60 of their best friends. And so they can be a little excited and you don't really see it until the next day. So you do get a baseline, but then I am checking the horses, you know, hopefully at least twice on the trail to look at their metabolics to see how they're doing.
All right. Yeah, cool. And what would you say is the most common thing that you see? What's the most common thing why horses are pulled?
Lameness.
Lameness. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if talking about lameness issues, and you know, like we're not just talking about, you know, their heart rate and their breathing. What are some of the other types of their bodies go through that might help prevent lameness if other parts of their body were in better condition?
Well, you do want to make sure you're conditioning muscles, you know, and all the muscle groups of the horses. You can, you know, have issues if muscle, they get tying up, if their muscles get exhausted and they get a lot of lactic acid buildup because they're just not used to all the work. Tendons and ligament issues. Here in Colorado, we have some people who try and go barefoot on some of the rides, and they realize that, you know, they're called the Rocky Mountains for a reason, so we end up with a lot of sole bruises.
I know the endurance riders are using a lot of boots. Do you guys tend to use a lot of boots, the ones who go barefoot?
They do, yeah. We do see a lot of boots as well.
Yeah, we were talking earlier about how it's not just about getting the horse in shape. And I know I've told new riders that the only way to get in shape for riding is to ride, but do you find that there are other types of exercises that the people can do that help them get in better shape for riding?
There's yoga for equestrian for riders. I had that as a topic at the National Convention here in Denver in 2008. I found somebody who did yoga specifically for equestrian riders. And walking also helps. Not that in our sport we get off and walk the horse as much on the trail, but walking can help you as well. Just build your cardiovascular system up.
I know yoga for horse people is becoming very popular now.
It is.
That's become a thing now.
Thing.
It's official.
Do you find that if people use electrolytes, that they can sometimes help a horse that may not be as in condition as it should be?
Oh, that's a big heated debate right now is the use of electrolytes. And, yes, it can help to a certain extent, but you're probably not going to be able to carry enough electrolytes along the trail with you to totally make up for the loss that they're seeing out there on the trail. And there's actually, I believe it was in, 2010 or 2011, the French and the Belgian endurance teams in their big competitions do not use electrolytes at all during competition, and they've had some success with that. So it is, again, a huge debate out there as to whether or not to electrolyte or not to electrolyte. And as long as you're, you know, not you have to do something for them, whether it's pre-ride, post-ride, or even during the ride. You need to do a little something to help them out, but you have to be real careful with it. And I do recommend there's a veterinarian by the name of Dr. Dane Frazier, who's done a lot of work in this electrolyte round. And if anybody's interested, they can find some of his information out there.
I'm a little confused as to what the debate is. What is the debate? Is it too much electrolyte?
To electrolyte or not to electrolyte. That's the big debate.
Is there any a negative to electrolyte? And I'm not talking overdoing it here. I'm not talking about tons of the stuff. But, you know, the normal amount anybody would use when your horse is maybe not drinking enough. Is there a negative to that?
You have to be careful about what your electrolyte mix is. You want to make sure that you're not giving the wrong types of electrolytes and making sure that they're not, you know, kind of too basic as in acid and base, because your horse is already getting into an issue. So you just want to be real careful about what type of electrolyte you're using. And the safest one, if you want to carry it with you out on the trail, is a combination of regular table salt and some light salt, equal parts of both, and try and give that to them along the trail. That would be the safest for people to use.
So what do you mean by safe? As in not good for your horse's health, or what makes a electrolyte
unsafe?
When
you get a commercial product, you have to be, like I said, just real careful that you're not giving them too much of a base, like again, the difference between acid and bases, too much of a basic electrolyte mix, because that can send them into a worse issue out there. So there's, you know, powders where you can just have sodium, salt, some calcium, and maybe some magnesium are probably the best.
I didn't realize that. I learned something new today.
Learn something every day.
Well, now I know that several of the top competitors have done their President's Cup runs never using electrolytes. So I know that's been a big,
correct,
you know, issue, or not issue, but a, you know, a big source of conversation amongst competitors.
Donna, we really appreciate you being here today. Do you have a website or a place that people can find you?
I don't have a website. That's way too much for me to handle. I do have an email. If anybody wants to email me, I will try my best to get back with you. And that is D as in Donna, LJDVM@yahoo.com.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Donna. We appreciate your insight, and I learned something new today.
All right. Thank you guys very much.
All right. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Well, that was very interesting. And, of course, what you guys do and the competitions that you do are the vet side of it is so very important. You know, it is as important as it is at the FEI competition. So it was interesting to hear that electrolyte conversation, too, because I'd never heard it. I didn't know there was a controversy revolving around electrolytes.
Well, I don't know if it's really a controversy so much. It's just some people really believe that it's not necessary. And the people who use them really believe that it helps their horses, and the people who don't use them tend to think that their horses are better because they don't need them. And so that's really the only – I mean, it's not really a controversy. Back when NATRC started, we could – if I'm remembering correctly, because it started over 50 years ago, but some of the rules included – not giving electrolytes on the trail, like you could give them in the food, but we didn't do what they called forced electrolytes. And then those rules have changed over the years as people have seen the benefit to their horsemanship. So I think that there's just some over thought that the electrolytes aren't always necessary.
Yeah, I can see that too. And I think some people do it. I think we've done it in the past when horses weren't good drinkers, and that's where you see, you know, that's where we've done it is with horses that weren't good drinkers. You know, some horses drink enough and they get enough food. They don't really need, they get enough water and enough food, they don't need the electrolytes.
True.
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, I know one thing that is not controversial, and that's hay nets. So tell us about Texas hay nets.
Texas Hay, all right. Well, Texas Hay Net is a company that is already a sponsor of NATRC. They are based in Texas, in the Texas Hill Country, and their owner's name is Leslie Walker Davis. She is a really, really neat lady who is very committed to horse nutrition. She's rehabbed a whole lot of laminitic horses, and she volunteers with a big organization we have down here called Bluebonnet Equine Rescue. She says that her hay nets, they fit over the over a round bale, and they work best on a 5 to 6 foot round bale, but they will work on smaller or larger. You know, they'll work on some smaller ones too. And you put your round bale in a ring, and then you attach the hay net over the top of the ring and secure it to the ring. And the horses then feed the round bale. And it'll make a round bale last for 3 horses up to 22 days because the horses aren't just
pulling it
off. Yeah, it's an amazing product. It is really, really cool. And so it may, and
all right, I have to ask you, though. I saw the pictures of these, and you know, it's been common knowledge here on the show that I am not qualified at hay nets, and no horse husband is. That it's one of our least favorite things to do is put hay in a hay net. So my question for you is how easy it is. I guess you're just sliding it over the top, so it's probably a lot easier than trying to. I can't imagine stuffing a round bale into a hay net.
No,
so,
yeah.
Okay.
They put the bale down. You put the feeder over the hay bale, and then you put the net over the whole thing.
Okay.
Now, but you can also use this if you don't have a feeder. Like, I don't have a hay ring, but I also have barefoot horses. So I can use this hay net. I just put the ends together over the round bale. Like, my daughter and I will, like, get it over most way, and then we roll the bale just a little more, and we can attach it. So they can still use it even though I don't have a hay ring. And,
so you don't worry about you don't worry about it getting caught up in it or anything without the hay ring?
Tiny. No, the holes are really small. She says you should never do that if the horse has shoes. If there's a single horse that's going to have shoes in the pasture,
they can get it caught.
It has to have a ring. But if you have barefoot horses, you can do that, but you can do it without a ring. But their food stays in their gut a lot longer this way. And so even if they eat a while and they leave, because they've eaten smaller amounts as they go, the food will stay, the hay will stay in their gut like 14 to 20 hours instead of like horses that just get thrown a flake of hay, you know, and then eat it and it's gone. And, I mean, it's just a remarkable product. On the website, they have a video that shows a time-lapse video of the hay being eaten out of the hay net. It's on the About page. There's a little time-lapse photography thing that shows how long the bale lasts.
Well, I'll tell you what, this is really cool because one of the other problems you have with the round bales, and this drives every horse person crazy, is when their horse spreads about half of it out and sleeps on it. So I assume that it solves that problem too.
It does, because it would be way too. I think even my horse would find it to be way too much work to do that. My daughter's mare is terrible about that. When we give her hay at night at a ride, we have to only give her a little bit because she'll take it and scoop it under herself and sleep on it instead of eating it.
Well, this is really cool. I'm looking at the pictures here, and it does look like a terrific idea. You know, it solves a number of problems, and it looks like it can be used for most of the 5 or 6 round bales. So that's not
and
a problem.
It'll save a lot of money, too, because you're not – having to, you know, feed as many round bales. Like, I have 4 horses, and they would eat a round bale in 2 weeks or less sometimes. And I actually have gone through I keep my round bale on the outside of the fence, and I just shovel it in to them as I want them to have it. But this solves that problem. They can get as much as they feel like they need, but they have to work out it a little more, just like a horse grazing on a range would have to do.
Huh, very interesting. This is it can be found at TexasHayNet.com. We'll take you there. You can order them right on the website there. There's also, as you said, there's a video, and it shows you a lot of pictures that show you it being used And, you know, and you know, the problem with down here in Florida is round bales are very expensive. Hay is getting very expensive, and round bales are very expensive, like a lot of parts of the country. So you want to really save as much of it as you can, and you do want to slow them down a little bit so that they're getting, you know, just a constant feeding instead of that gorging like some horses do on round bales.
Exactly.
Terrific idea. Yeah, I didn't even know this existed. So it is TexasHayNet.com. We're going to take a break for our song of the day. I have Templeton Thompson for you, and it's singing a song about something that every trail rider should have, every rider should have, and that's a guardian angel. So this song is called Guardian Angel. We're coming back to talk more about trail riding and camping, and we're going to get into a little bit of the camping here coming up in a minute. Right after this song from Templeton Thompson.
She could have passed for a cowboy the way she carried herself, and that 50 pounds of leather put it up on that pony light as a feather, like she'd done it all her life. And she asked if I was ready, handing me the reins, and we started out walking. Up until that morning, she hadn't been much on talking. Guess it finally come the time, and she said, I've learned more from the back of a horse than most folks ever get to know. You never really know what you're made of till you ride out on your own.
Well, Well, that was Templeton Thompson with Guardian Angel. You can find all of Templeton's music at templetonthompson.com or find her on iTunes. Just search for Templeton Thompson. You're listening to Horses in the Morning. I am Glenn the Geek, and I am here with her debut, Alice. It's Jovich, right?
Yes, that's right.
Alice Jovich. And Coach Jen is in the producer chair, and you are listening to the special trail riding episode here on Horses in the Morning, brought to you by the North American Trail Ride Conference. And while we're waiting for our next guest here to get lined up, I wanted to talk to you about getting back to a little bit of your history. So you're still active. Are you an officer with the NATRC, or what's your spot?
Okay. I'm not an officer with the NATRC. It's actually kind of funny. I joke that I am the Ron Paul of running for board because I keep running for the board every time a position comes open, and they always vote for the other guy. But that's okay. There's so many other jobs to be done. I have been a ride manager since 2010. I have put on two rides at a ranch in South Texas near Houston called the 7IL Ranch. And then I put on a ride a year and a half ago at a ranch called Trace Trails. And I'm about to do that ride again in 2 weeks. So Trace Trails is in Athens, Texas, and it's beautiful. Right now the dogwoods are blooming, and by 2 weeks from now the redbud should be out. So I'm looking forward to that.
Sounds neat. Now, how many people will you have at a ride? How many people will show up?
Typically, right now, we'll have about 30 at a ride. In the past, the last few years, the economy's kind of taken a nosedive a little bit. And we used to have upwards of 60, but it just seems like people are working longer hours and it's harder for them to get there. But, you know, we're working on building our numbers again, and I know that there's a ride in Oklahoma, not this weekend, but next weekend, and she already has about 35 people signed up. They're going to have a clinic and a competition, so a clinic on Friday and then a competition on Saturday and Sunday, and that's at the Lake Carl Blackwell in Stillwater, Oklahoma. So if anybody is thinking they'd like to give it a try, that would be a really great first ride for them because there's a clinic and they can kind of get walked through all the steps of how to do a ride and then go compete.
And I know you guys have a magazine. It's called Hoofprint for the members of the NATRC. One of the reasons that I joined the American Driving Society is I love getting the Whip, which is their magazine. And I love getting the Whip because of all the pretty pictures of all the pretty carriages and horses. So I'm sure that the members of the NATRC look forward to the Hoofprint when it comes out as well.
We do. And fortunately, it's available to anyone that wants to read it digitally on the website. So if they go to natrc.org, they can look at Hoofprints right there on the website.
And I was just looking at it and saw you got you with your certificate there. You were in it this time. And, of course, all the mileage horses are in there as well, the ones who are achieving, like Larry Golden, his 14,000 miles, which is a lot of miles, by the way.
It is a lot of miles. Larry's been a longtime competitor, and he is a pillar of our Region 4 community.
Well, let's introduce our next guest.
Our next guest is Alana. She has been riding NATRC since 2002, and she started out as a tent camper and still has only just moved into a gooseneck trailer that's a shell with no amenities. She's been a backpacker since 1986 and has backpacked all over the United States. She's a Cub Scout leader and a Boy Scout mom, and she rides fox trotters and has mentored several juniors, including her granddaughter, who has just started competing.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question before we get started. So you just have low self-esteem and like to torture yourself. Is that what that's about? Just asking.
I like being where I can hear the birds, see the stars, smell the flowers, And when you're locked up in your little metal box, you really can't do all of that. So
windows open, so you can hear all of that lovely thing while having your shower and your toilet.
This is true. There are many places that I can go that they can't go with the big rigs. So that's part of the advantage. And then definitely with backpacking as opposed to regular what we call car camping, you get away from the crowds and the people and get out into nature, which is what camping is supposed to be all about.
You know, we have a sponsor, Equity Manufacturing, and Joseph, who runs Equity, his mother, we had her on one of the endurance episodes we did because she is, Jennifer, I think it was 85 or something. It was up there. And she still goes to the endurance rides and sleeps in her tent on the ground, or sleeps in her sleeping bag on the ground, no tent, no nothing.
Awesome.
She still does it that way at 85. So more
and
power
she's
to
85
her.
And still riding. Aha. Uh-huh.
Yes, still doing endurance rides. So.
There we go. There we go. Obviously, it's a healthy alternative.
That's right. So tell me about some of the camp setups that you have seen work well for you on Horse Weekend.
Well, I would say coming from a background of safety as well as because I'm an ER nurse as well as a camper, you want to be safe and you want to be comfortable. So your main objectives when you're trying to be comfortable are to be dry, not to be too hot, not to be too cold, and not to get wet. Wet is very uncomfortable. And so you're going to set up your site so that your tent is clear of your horse. I like to set it up so the window door to my tent is where I can open it and quickly look at my horse in the middle of the night. But you definitely want to look at the water flow to make sure that you're not in an area where if it rains hard, the water's going to pour into your tent. You want to have a fairly level spot. You want to clear off any debris underneath where your tent is going to be because tents are delicate and you don't want to poke a hole in the bottom of your tent and you don't want to sleep on a rock. You want to definitely make sure that you are not under the tallest tree in camp in case there's a lightning storm. And under trees in general, you want to be very careful about not being under anything that looks like a dead tree or a tree with a dead limb because obviously you have no protection if that comes down on you. So other things that I would say for sure are low-profile tents, so backpacking tents or smaller tents, stand up to the abuses of wind, which in Texas we have a lot of, as opposed to the bigger, what I like to call Taj Mahal tents. The giant tents have a big wind profile, and so the wind will take them. If you stake them very well, you might be okay, but the smaller tents in general stand up to the wind better and are much easier to set up. Less time to set up, less space needed to set up, so that gives you more versatility of where you put it. So you just need to make sure that you really pay attention to where you set the tent up. It avoids a lot of problems through the weekend. So.
Well, we can discuss the wind from a very recent point of view, can't we?
Yes.
This last weekend, Alana managed to ride, and the winds were 20 to 45 miles per hour all weekend. And not this time, but one of the first times she put on this ride, I brought a Taj Mahal tent. And do you remember what happened to it?
Yes, it blew away.
It blew away.
Were you in it at the time?
No. But it had three cots and three people's gear and all our food and a table and an open bottle of apple cider.
Oh.
Yeah. It didn't go very far, but it was a mess.
Oh, yuck. All of that all mixed together like a blender.
Yeah. It was,
and this
it
is
was
why Glenn doesn't want to sleep in a tent.
Exactly. You guys aren't talking me into this, you know.
No,
you're supposed
you
to be trying to convince me.
But I was going to say, too, that I have a tent that she recommended to me that I still have, that we still use, and it's a Eureka Tetragon tent. She said that was what the backpackers, the kids, used to use for Boy Scouts. And that tent is amazing. It doesn't blow over. It doesn't even flap. It just stays where you put it.
Don't any of these rides start in the yard at the Hampton Inn?
I'm afraid not.
No.
However, we're always looking for new locations and new ride managers, Glenn. So if you find a place, let us know.
Okay.
There you go.
I mean, we do have a couple rides, actually. There is a place that we do ride that has bunkhouse you can stay in. You can tie your horse to the trailer and stay in the bunkhouse.
Let's see, now that I'd do. That sounds comfy. Yeah.
Well, actually, for a while when we were doing Horse Masters, we could stay in their hotel there. Do you remember that?
That's right. Yes, I do remember.
That's in Big Sandy, Texas. They have a facility there that has hotels kind of a probably – dorm is probably more like it. So safety, and you want to make sure that your tents, most of the tents now are very well ventilated, and that's important to us in Region 4 because it can get so hot. So a lot of the times the newer tents are mostly screening and then with a solid floor, and then the tent itself has a what we call a rain fly or a cover that goes over it, and those protect you from the weather, obviously. So you have options of taking the rain fly off and on. And in general, the rain fly is usually just clipped to the tent, and then there's usually a few ropes also. So getting to the ropes on the tent, you want to make sure that you have set all of your tent up ahead of time. You want to have what we call a ground cloth. Another word for it is a footprint. That is measured, cut to measure. You can either get a drop cloth from Home Depot and cut it to measure the footprint of your tent, not bigger, not smaller, or you can actually buy what they call a footprint. And that prevents sticks, rocks from going up under your tent. It also gives you extra protection from the moisture of the ground getting up through your tent. So you want to set that up ahead of time, and you also want to set all of your strings up ahead of time. And I like to use a thin cord, and they usually come with the tent. And I set it up with what they call a trucker's hitch, which is a knot that you can use that easily tightens and also easily loosens and comes undone for when you're taking the tent down. The tents that I like to use are backpacking tents. And in general, if you have a two-person tent, that's good for one person. And if you have a three-person tent, that's good for two people, because a single-person tent literally holds one person. Doesn't have room for your gear. Another rule with tenting is you don't want anything touching the edge of the tent. Anything that touches the edge of the tent, if it's raining, is going to wick the moisture into the tent. Because even though the tent is water-resistant, it can't be completely waterproof. Otherwise, all your moisture from breathing is going to build up and condense on the inside of the tent. So it's important to make sure that you have enough room in the tent for your gear so that everything isn't crammed up against the side of the tent. The other thing that's important with the whole moisture control thing is your is your clothing. There's a saying in camping that cotton kills, and that's because cotton holds moisture, and if you have a cotton T-shirt that gets wet on Friday, you're going to still have a wet T-shirt on Monday morning. So technical wear, polypro, polyester, base layer for like you can either get them in T-shirts or long john style, and then a polar fleece middle layer and a rain jacket, windbreaker, outer layer will prepare you for any kind of weather. That will take you from hot to snow with just three layers. But cotton is a no in the outdoors. Just not a wise idea. Jeans are bad. Cotton T-shirts are bad. If you want those in your gear so that's nice when you get back to camp and you want to put them on, that's fine. But whenever you're exposed to the weather, you just stay away from the cotton.
Elena, have they figured out how to hook up the air conditioner to the side of the tent yet?
Well, actually, I have seen that.
I have seen that.
If you have electric, I've seen people hook up a window air conditioning unit into their tent. But if at night, once it gets cooler, it really isn't as bad as you think. And then my saving item that I like the best is a small battery-powered fan. Obviously, you can use electric one if you have electric sight, but I use a brand called O2, and it's just letter O, like oxygen, O2, cool. And that fan is small, lightweight, very quiet, has two speeds, and it runs on either batteries, 12-volt, or electric. So you have three different options. And it, if you place that fan a foot or two away from your face and blow it on your face, you can be comfortable in 90-plus degrees in a tent. It's amazing how that little bit of airflow makes all the difference in the world. So I've never been overly hot in a tent as long as I had a fan. Without the fan, not so much.
So I have a question for you about food.
Yes.
When you're camping, what types of food do you like to take with you? You know, like, talk about, like, simple setups if someone's really going, like, you know, they want to make it really easy, to some of the equipment you could have to have more cooked, you know, food if you prefer.
Yes, well, I'll start with the most streamlined, and that's what I've learned to do over the years, because I decided that spending all my time in camp cooking and picking up from cooking was not my idea of fun, especially when I'm trying to take care of my horse. So if you want to go the most bare bones, then you pack yogurt or power drink, Boost or Muscle Milk or some kind of protein drink. And I do the Starbucks cappuccino, so I'll take a cappuccino and a Boost in the morning so I don't have to cook or clean up anything, warm up anything. And then I'll pack some kind of trail mix and protein bars to have on the trail with water, of course. And then dinner can be as simple as sandwiches. So right there you're talking about, you know, peanut butter and jelly. So you're talking about no need for a cooler, no need for cooking, no need for much cleanup at all. So that's the most basic way of getting, you know, survivable calories in.
But Elena, you're killing me here. The only thing I liked about camping was smelling the bacon cooking around in the morning.
Well, you got to remember, we're up at 5 feeding the horse, and we're on the trail at 7 in the morning. And in that time, we've got to walk the horse, tack the horse, feed the horse, warm the horse up. So it gets to be logistically a pain to do a lot of cooking. But so let's upgrade the next level. So
okay.
You can get Coleman stove. But Coleman makes the simplest, easy-to-use camp stoves. Get a little cheap two-burner Coleman stove from Walmart that runs on a propane canister. The only thing you have to do is set it up, is open it up. It's like a little suitcase. You open it up, clip the little sides in. You've got one little connector between the stove and the Coleman canister. Turn it on, boil your water, or put your coffee pot on, and you've got coffee. You've got water for oatmeal, hot chocolate. And so that's the next level, and I do often do that. And that was for coffee, what I found that works well, rather than trying to deal with a little percolator on the camp stove, is Folgers makes a thing called coffee singles, and they're like tea bags. So you just put your hot water in your cup, and you dunk in your coffee single, and you've got your coffee. So for other simple meals that don't require a lot of gear, you can either make your meals at home and steal your friend's microwave, or you can take a small microwave yourself, obviously, if you have a hookup site with electric, or soups, like chunky soups or homemade soups, you can warm up on the Coleman stove for when you get in the afternoon. So that's level number two. Now, if you want to go, you know, you really enjoy your food, and that's a super important part of your camping, then the Coleman stove is there. You know, you get your fry pan out, you do your bacon and eggs for breakfast. You can get, Coleman makes little ovens. You can make biscuits for breakfast if you want to. And then one of the items that I like, and I don't usually take it camping again because I've gone real bare bones, is a portable gas grill. And caution about that, I think I've been through four of them. Invest in a good one. They're just tabletop size. They're light, easy to carry. But the one that I use now is a Weber.
I was gonna say that one. That one's a good one. Yep.
Yeah. Go with the Weber because you can buy the cheap ones and they don't heat up.
And they're cheap.
Yeah. They don't heat up. They don't last. They don't work. So get the Weber and then you can grill your chicken, grill your steak. You know, have your salad and whatever you want with it. One of the other things we do that consumes a little bit more time is cooking with Dutch ovens.
Oh, I love Dutch ovens. Yeah.
Dutch ovens are super easy also because all you need is some briquettes and a match, and they don't take up much room, and you can cook wonderful meals with them. My husband's famous for making cobbler in Dutch ovens. So there's all levels
then,
you can go. It's
and then when you make a real meal in the Dutch oven, you line the edges with bacon. That's the first thing you do. See, I'm always back to the bacon here.
Yes, bacon.
I do have a couple questions. We're running out of time here, but
okay.
I wanted to ask you guys. One of the things that happens at every my wife was a three-day eventer, and one of the things that happens at every event, we talk about this all the time, is horses getting loose. Do you have that issue here? In camp?
Yes. And the horses rat out the other horses, because as soon as one horse is loose, every horse he walks by goes meh.
Yeah.
So those of us that are in tents and not in our RVs with the AC running where we don't hear it, we hear the horses loose. So yes, occasionally we do have horses get loose.
Karen said last, what was it, two rides ago when she was out on an endurance ride, two Arabs got loose and just wrecked the place. I mean, running into other horses, tearing the place apart. And that's usually what happens at an event is the horses tearing across the parking lot and there's people screaming. And
this is why NATRC does not allow electric pens, because electric pens are famous for loose horses.
Mm-hmm.
And then we spend a lot of time, you know, we do trailer checks as part of our horsemanship. So the horsemanship judge actually comes around and checks to make sure that you've tied with a quick release knot, that the rope is the appropriate length, that everything is as safe as it can be. It's part of our horsemanship judging. So everybody's getting pretty savvy about how they tie. And we usually use, most of us use a bull snap on our halters as opposed to a trigger snap, because the trigger snap, when the horse puts their head in a bucket, can actually open up the trigger snap. Yeah. So that's kind of a handy trick to prevent the loose horse.
Well, Alana, unfortunately,
yes.
We are out of time already.
Okay.
We could probably talk about this for another 20 minutes anyway. But
I have to go to work.
That's true. So do I. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Welcome.
I really appreciate it.
So did I swing you over, Glenn?
I like the last statement you made, the people who were in the campers where they couldn't hear what was going on outside. That really caught my attention.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
It's not like I don't totally hate camping. I think I hate camping in a tent. I think that's where the hatred came from.
Well,
I actually like
campground. There's other ways to do it. Well, you know, there's some other ways to do it. Like some people will pitch a cot in the back of their trailer. Or like I drive a Suburban, and Alana, in fact, gave me a platform when they sold their Suburban, and I have all my gear stored under the platform, and I have a real mattress on top, and that's where I sleep.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of stuff isn't so bad. I mean, that's not too bad. Because then you can be in and out of the rain. You know, you don't have to be worrying about touching the side of the tent. You know, when she talked about that, I mean, how many times Jennifer and I have slept in a tent where you get soaked by morning because you're not awake and you're rolling over and you're touching the side of the tent.
Well, at one of the one of my rides, or one of the rides, I saw a guy, he had these PVC things inside his trailer, and he, like, made a tent inside the trailer, but he had an air conditioner, so he had air conditioning under his tarp tent inside the trailer, and that's where he camped.
That's funny. Well, let's talk about the calendar, the NATRC calendar.
All right. There are a lot of rides upcoming for NATRC, and the entire calendar will be on natrc.org. But some of the ones coming up in the next couple weeks, April 26th and 27th, is the Oklahoma Run for the Mustangs in Stillwater, Oklahoma, at Lake Carl Blackwell. And there's a clinic on Friday, and then a one-day ride on Saturday, and then a two-day ride, you know, both Saturday and Sunday. The same weekend, there's a ride in Troy, North Carolina, at the Uary National Forest, and that's in Region 5. The ride that I manage, Without a Trace, in Athens, Texas, it's at a place called Trace Trails, and that's a very friendly, barefoot-friendly, flat ride for anybody who's thinking about trying this out. May 3rd and 4th is also the Knickers and Nays ride at Perry State Park, Perry Lake, Kansas, and I think it's Oswaukee, Kansas, but and then May 10th and 11th is Navajo Lake CTR at Navajo Lake State Park, New Mexico. And then there are more, but because this is starting to get to be the busy time of year, the weather gets good.
And the more they can find it, NATRC.org is where you can find the rest of the rides. Just hop on there and look at the calendar. I was just looking at the calendar, actually. And then, of course, you have the ride that you're running here very shortly.
Yes. That's the Trace Trails ride. We have a one-day ride on both Saturday and Sunday. So if somebody can't ride Saturday, they could come and just ride Sunday. And that's some separate competition. Plus, you could come and ride 2 days. If it weren't right after Rolex, I'd try to talk you guys into coming. And then you'll be recovering from Rolex.
Yeah, we'll be recovering from our trip next week. Well, this has been great. It's been a lot of fun talking to you. Jennifer's going to tell us real quick what is coming up for our prizes tomorrow on the Really Bad Ads. What happens here on Friday is our most popular segment we do on Horses in the Morning. Everybody, we have double the listeners on Friday than any other day, and it's because of Really Bad Ads. Our listeners submit to us really bad Craigslist ads where people are trying to sell horses or carriages or trailers or pigs or goats. And we just have a little fun reading them. So we give out prizes for the best ones. What are those tomorrow, Jennifer?
On the prize table this week, we have prizes from Dr. Rose's Remedies, Skin Treatment, and Salve. Dr. Rose's Skin Treatment, we're going to go backwards. Rewind. Dr. Rose's Skin Treatment and Salve and Spray are 100% all-natural products. They are anti-inflammatory, antibacterial, antiviral, and antifungal. Ain't nothing going to grow in there. Dr. Rose's are made with all human-grade ingredients and are safe and effective treatments for all manner of cuts and scrapes on your horse or pony. And Dr. Rose's are the must-have product here at HRN headquarters to keep BT Scooter's delicate white pasterns free from dew poisoning. Ask for Dr. Rose's at your local tack store, or you can visit them online at drrosesremedies.com. And also, we have prizes from Uncle Jimmy's Hanging Balls. Uncle Jimmy's Hanging Balls, Licky Things, and Squeezy Buns help combat stall boredom by providing your horse entertainment in the stall while at the same time providing them with much-needed minerals and nutrients that are not found in other treats or are left at the bottom of the feed bin. Dr. Rose's Uncle Jimmy training treats covered too with Uncle Jimmy's Squeezy Buns. The every single deliciously soft, squishy treat is individually wrapped for freshness, and your puckets don't get gummed up. Ask for Uncle Jimmy's Hanging Balls, Licky Things, and Squeezy Buns at your local tack and feed store, or you can visit them online at uncle-jimmys.com.
Do your horses like Uncle Jimmy's Hanging Balls, Ellen?
I don't know. I should have to get them and try that. They probably
You're going to have to try it. Every horse loves Uncle Jimmy's. They all love Uncle Jimmy's Hanging Balls, and the Squeezy Buns are really nice for treats and also for feeding pills and stuff. for medicine. So you'll have to try it out. We love Uncle Jimmy. Well, that's it for today. Thank you so much. As I said at the beginning of the show, the North American Trail Ride Conference will be with us on the third Thursday of every month, talking about trail riding and all things involved in that competition. And we have a lot more that I wanted to ask about and talk about. So we'll get to that in the upcoming months. Thank you, Alice. You did great.
Thank you. I look forward to coming back.
You can find, if you didn't catch all of today's show, you can go back and catch the rest of it on our app. It's free and it's easy to use. If you have a smartphone, iOS or Android, just go to the App Store, search for Horse Radio Network, download it, and as I said, it's the simplest way to listen to our shows, or go to horsesinthemorning.com, and you can catch all, almost 900 past episodes of Horses in the Morning. We'll be back here tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. If you want to submit an ad for Really Bad Ads, get it into Jennifer at horseradionetwork.com and copy and paste the whole ad into the email. Send it over to Jennifer, and we'll get it included in tomorrow's show. We'll see you, Alice. You have a great show later on.
Thanks. Have a great day.
Take care, everybody. Be safe. Wear your helmets. Thinking about starting to ride in the Hamptons.